Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. It is now or never, and that debt is fraud. We don't owe a penny. We need to continue to learn. We need to continue to pray, and we need to continue to act upon those prayers as we descend, or basically appeal to heaven, descend. Descend from heaven. So, anyway, the focus is full compliance. We can't cherry pick what, you know, well, we want you to do this, but we like these things you do for us. We can't allow any of that, folks. Can't allow any of it. We have to amend the Constitution, and the best thing to do is to actually not even think about amending the Constitution until we get compliance. And there's only a few amendments that I recommend. And none of them are in the Liberty Amendments or in the queue for the Convention of States because they don't understand the Constitution. They think that, oh, well, we'll, you know, poke some ideas around. And every single one of their ideas are fatal. They would actually undermine the Constitution, like the balanced budget amendment, term limits, and so forth. So, anywho, we're in the Virginia ratification phase. We just covered Madison regarding the exclusive legislation, as well as his little complaint that the anti-federalists are revisiting an old issue that, you know, get over it, guys. So now we're going to pick up the next comment on, just want to make sure, this is on Tuesday, June 17th. Madison was the first comment. Now we're going to pick up the comment by George Nicholas regarding slavery. Go ahead.
Okay. Mr. George Nicholas wondered that gentlemen who were against slavery should be opposed to this clause, as after that period, the slave trade would be done away. He asked if gentlemen did not see the inconsistency of their arguments. They object, says he, to the Constitution because the slave trade is laid open for 20-odd years, and yet they tell you that by some latent operation of it, the slaves who are so now will be manumitted? Is that how you say that? At the same time, or at the same moment, it is opposed for being promotive and destructive of slavery. He contended that it was advantageous to Virginia that it should be in the power of Congress to prevent the importation of slaves after 20 years, as it would then put a period to the evil, then put a period to the evil complained of.
Yeah, manumitted. As the Southern, you had it right. Go ahead.
I did. As the Southern states would not confederate without this clause, he asked if gentlemen would rather dissolve the Confederacy than to suffer this temporary inconvenience, admitting it to be such. Virginia might continue the prohibition of such importation during the intermediate period and would be benefited by it, as a tax of $10 on each slave might be laid, of which she would receive a share. He endeavored to obviate the objection of gentlemen that the restriction on Congress was a proof that they would have powers not given them by remarking that they would only have had a general superintendency of trade if the restriction had not been inserted. But the Southern states insisted on this exception to that general superintendency for 20 years. It could not, therefore, have been a power by implication, as the restriction was an exception from the delegated power. The taxes could not, as he had suggested, be laid so high on Negroes as to amount to emancipation, because taxation and representation were fixed according to the census established in the Constitution. The exception of taxes from the uniformity annexed to duties and excises cannot have the operation contended for by the gentlemen, because other clauses had clearly and positively fixed the census.
Okay, so right there, the exception of taxes from the uniformity annexed on or annexed to duties, which is the direct tax. In other words, uniformity had to be applied on all direct taxes and excise taxes. To be clear, that means that a income tax needs to be uniform throughout the states and upon the people who are taxed, which means that Tammy should be paying what I pay, and you should be paying what we pay, the same percentage. It must be uniform. This right here lays out how the 16th Amendment is deliberately and literally, the way it's being executed, is violating the uniformity clause. I just wanted to point that out. So you
okay, had taxes been uniform, it would have been universally objected to, for no one object could be selected without involving great inconveniences and oppressions. But says Mr. Nicholas, it is from the general government we are to... Is it from the general government we are to fear emancipation? Gentlemen will recollect what I said in another house and what other gentlemen have said that advocated emancipation. Give me leave to say that clause is great security for our tax, our slave tax. I can tell the committee that people of our country are reduced to beggary by the taxes on Negroes. Had this constitution been adopted, it would not have been the case. The taxes were laid on all our Negroes. By this system, two-fifths are exempted. He then added that he had not imagined gentlemen would support here what they had opposed in another place.
So you know how the two-fifths is exempted on taxes of all Negroes, or all slaves?
Mm-hmm.
Because the apportionment above in Article 1 basically says for every slave, they have three-fourths, they count as three-fourths of a person, or three-fifths, I mean. So that means that they count for three-fifths for a vote or for representation, and they count three-fifths on taxation as well. So in other words, they get the slave or the plantation owners have to pay that additional tax upon those three-fifths heads. Because apportionment and taxation go hand in hand. It had to be uniform. So how the uniform direct tax was being applied, they had an additional tax, a one-time only tax that would be created until the slave trade was shut down, $10 per head of all slaves coming into America, they had to pay that tax. So that way, you know, with all the slaves coming in, the United States government would receive the $10. So, anyhow, go ahead.
Okay, so now we've gone down to Mr. Madison.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry, that's slaves. Right. You just finished it. So, the importation of slaves. Yeah, go ahead. Thank you.
Yeah. Mr. Madison replied that even the southern states, which were most affected, were perfectly satisfied with this provision and dreaded no danger to the property they now hold. It appeared to him that the general government would not intermeddle with that property for 20 years, but to lay a tax on every slave imported not exceeding $10, and that after the expiration of that period, they might prohibit the traffic altogether. The census in the Constitution was intended to introduce equality in the burdens to be laid on the community. No gentleman objected to laying duties, imposts, and excises uniformly, but uniformity of taxes would be subversive of the principles of equality, for it was not possible to select any article which would be easy for one state but what would be heavy for another. That the proportion of each state being ascertained, it would be raised by the general government in the most convenient manner for the people, and not by the selection of any one particular object. That there must be some degree of confidence put in agents, or else we must reject a state of civil society altogether. Another great security to this property which he mentioned was that five states were greatly interested in that species of property, that there were other states which had some slaves and had made no attempt or taken any step to take them from the people. There were a few slaves in New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut. These states would probably oppose any attempts to annihilate this species of property. He concluded by observing that he should be glad to leave the decision of this to the committee.
Okay. And then they read the fifth and sixth clauses. So, okay. So now we go down to Governor Randolph regarding general powers.
You there?
Getting there. Hold on.
Okay.
Okay, there we are.
All right. There we go. Go ahead.
Let me say that, in my opinion, the adversaries of the Constitution wander equally from the true meaning. If it would not fatigue the House too far, I would go back to the question of reserved rights. The gentleman supposes that complete and unlimited legislation is vested in the Congress of the United States. This supposition is founded in false reasoning. What is the present situation of this state? She has possession of all rights of sovereignty except those given to Confederation. She must delegate powers to the Confederate government. It is necessary for her public happiness. Her weakness compels her to confederate with the 12 other governments. She trusts certain powers to the general government in order to support, protect, and defend the Union. Now, is there not a demonstrable difference between the principle of the state government and that of the general government? There is not a word said in the state government of the powers given to it because they are general. But in the general Constitution, its powers are enumerated. It is not, then, fairly deducible that it has no power but what is expressly given it, for if its powers were to be general, an enumeration would be needless.
Okay,
the assertion of the negative restrictions has given cause of triumph, it seems, to gentlemen. They suppose that it demonstrates that Congress are to have powers by implication. I will meet them on that ground. I persuade myself that every exception here mentioned is an exception, not from general powers, but from the particular powers there invested. To what power in the general government is the exception made respecting the importation of Negroes? Not from a general power, but from a particular power expressly enumerated. This is an exception from the power given them of regulating commerce. He asks, where is the power to which the prohibition of suspending the habeas corpus is an exception? I contend that by virtue of the power given to Congress to regulate courts, they could suspend the right of habeas corpus. This is therefore an exception to that power. The third restriction is that no bill of attainder or ex facto law shall be passed. This is a manifest exception to another power. We know well that attainers and ex post facto laws have always been the engines of criminal jurisprudence. This is, therefore, an exception to the criminal jurisdiction vested in that body. The fourth restriction is that no capitation or other direct tax shall be laid unless in proportion to the census before directed to be taken. Our debates show from what power this is an exception. The restrictions in the fifth clause are an exemption to the power of regulating commerce. The restriction in the sixth clause that no money should be drawn from the treasury but in consequence of appropriations made by law is an exception to the power of paying the debts of the United States. For the power of drawing money from the treasury is consequential of that of paying the public debts. The next restriction is that no titles of nobility shall be granted by the United States. If we cast our eyes to the manner in which titles of nobility first originated, we shall find this restriction founded on the same principles. These sprang from military and civil offices. Both are put in the hands of the United States, and therefore I presume it to be an exception to that power. The last restriction restrains any person in office from accepting of any present or emolument, title, or office from any foreign prince or state. It must have been observed before that though the Confederation had restricted Congress from exercising any powers not given them, yet they inserted it not from any apprehension of usurpation, but for greater security. This restriction is provided to prevent corruption. All men have a natural inherent right of receiving emoluments from anyone unless they be restrained by the regulations of the community. An accident which actually happened operated in producing the restriction. A box was presented to our ambassador by the king of our allies. It was thought proper, in order to exclude corruption and foreign influence, to prohibit anyone in office from receiving or holding any emoluments from foreign states. I believe that if at that moment, when we were in harmony with the King of France, we had supposed that he was corrupting our ambassador, it might have disturbed that confidence and diminished that mutual friendship which contributed to carry us through the war.
That was an interesting point.
Yeah.
As he kind of explained, you know, that there are these exceptions, but that's an interesting point. But keep going. Go ahead.
Yeah. The honorable gentleman observed that Congress might define punishments from petty larceny to high treason. This is an unfortunate quotation. This is a question. This is an unfortunate quotation, or the gentleman, because treason is expressly defined in the third section of the third article, and they can add no feature to it. They have not cognizance over any other crime except piracies, felonies committed on the high seas, and offenses against the law of nations. But the rhetoric of the gentleman has highly colored the dangers of giving the general government an infinite power of providing for the general welfare. I contend that no such power is given. They have power to lay and collect taxes, duties, imposts, and excises, to pay the debts, and provide for the common defense and general welfare of the United States. Is this an independent, separate, substantive power to provide for the general welfare of the United States? No, sir. They can lay and collect taxes, etc. For what? To pay the debts and provide for the general welfare. Were not this the case, the following part of the clause would be absurd. It would have been treason against common language. Take it all together, and let me ask the plain interpretation, be not this. A power to lay and collect taxes, etc., in order to provide for the general welfare and pay debts.
All right, keep going. These are all
coming
out
of the subject of the Bill of Rights.
These are all coming out of the restrictions.
Okay. On the subject of the Bill of Rights, the want of which has been complained of, I will observe that it has been sanctified by such revered authority that if I feel some difficulty in going against it, I shall not, however, be deterred from giving my opinion on this occasion, let the consequence be what it may. At the beginning of the war, we had no certain Bill of Rights, for our charter cannot be considered as a Bill of Rights. It is nothing more than an investiture in the hands of the Virginia citizens of those rights which belong to British subjects. When the British thought proper to infringe our rights, it was not necessary to mention in our Constitution those rights which ought to be paramount to the power of the legislature. Why is the Bill of Rights distinct from the Constitution? I consider a Bill of Rights in this view, that the government should use them when there is a departure from its fundamental principles in order to restore them. This is the true sense of Bill of Rights. If it be consistent with the Constitution or contain additional rights, why not put it in the Constitution? If it be repugnant to the Constitution, here will be a perpetual scene of warfare between them. The honorable gentleman has praised the Bill of Rights of Virginia and called it his guardian angel, and vilified this Constitution for not having it. Give me leave to make a distinction between the representatives of the people of a particular country who are appointed as the ordinary legislature, having no limitation to their powers, and another body arising from that compact, and with certain delineated powers. Were a Bill of Rights necessary in the former, or would not be in the latter? For the best security that can be in the latter is the express enumeration of its powers. But let me ask the gentleman where his favorite rights are violated. They are not violated by the 10th section, which contains restrictions on the states. Are they violated by the enumerated powers? Here, His Excellency read from the 8th to the 12th article of the Bill of Rights. Is there not provision made in this Constitution for the trial by jury in criminal cases? Does not the 3rd article provide that the trial of all crimes shall be by jury and held where he said crime shall have been committed? Does it not follow that the cause and nature of the accusation must be produced? Because otherwise they cannot proceed on the cause. Everyone knows that the witnesses must be brought before the jury, or else the prisoner will be discharged. Calling of evidence in his favor is coincident to his trial. There is no suspicion that less than 12 jurors will be thought sufficient. The only defect is that there is no speedy trial. Consider how this could have been amended. We have heard complaints against it because it is supposed the jury is to come from the state at large. It will be in the powers to have juries from the vicinage. And would not the complaints have been louder if they had appointed a federal court to be had in every county in the state? Criminals are brought in this state from every part of the country to the general court, and jurors from the vicinage are summoned to the trials. There can be no reason to prevent the general government from adopting a similar regulation. As to the exclusion of excessive bail and fines and cruel and unusual punishment, this would follow of itself without a Bill of Rights. Observations have been made about watchfulness over those in power which deserve our attention. There must be a combination. We must presume corruption in the House of Representatives, Senate, and President before we can suppose that excessive fines can be imposed or cruel punishments inflicted. Their number is the highest security. Numbers are the highest security in our own Constitution, which has attracted so many eulogiums from the gentlemen. Here we have launched into a sea of suspicions. How shall we check power? By their numbers. Before these cruel punishments can be inflicted, laws must be passed and judges must judge contrary to justice. This would excite universal discontent and detestation of the members of the government. They might involve their friends and the calamities resulting from it, and could be removed from office. I never desire greater security than this, which I believe to be absolutely sufficient.
Well, that was a mouthful.
Yes, it was.
Yes, it was. Yeah, so there were a few points that I was trying to inject, but not many. And that's okay, because I think there may be either the latency or delay. You just didn't get it.
Yeah, for some reason I can't hear a lot of times.
Oh, okay. All right. So now we've got this laid out. And actually, there's one more part that still needs to be read, which is the common law part. And we've got barely 2 minutes left, and it's a couple of paragraphs. So we'll cover Governor Rand. So as a matter of fact, you probably noticed that they referred to him as His Excellency. Governor Randolph is actually serving as governor at this point in time. And it was kind of unusual that a governor attended the ratification debates from the states, as well as, or I should say, the Constitutional Convention, because Randolph was in the Constitutional Convention as the governor of Virginia. And he was involved in the ratification debates as well. And he did not sign the Constitution. So he was perceived as an anti-federalist. And he made statements to say, you know, I see problems with this Constitution, which, going into the ratification debates, he realized that the Constitution was far better to be ratified than the principles that he held in his head at the time to withhold his signature. And he actually regretted that. He actually came out and said, later on, he regretted not signing it, because he realized over time that the Constitution was so superior in so many ways in preserving the Union. So anyway, well, we're getting through this. I mean, we'll probably in the next few weeks get this done, because Virginia's long. I mean, we're at page 300 of 430 around that point. So this is a full,
that's great,
vigorous debate. So anything, any comments before we adjourn and talk next time? Anything you're learning? I mean,
well,
some of this
actually,
stuff is
this
good,
is just,
right?
This is just the break.
Oh, you're right. I thought that we're coming up to the end. Thank you for pointing that out. Boy, I have some real problems with my head today. But I guess I need another stimulating drink. Well, with that, I'm going to go get a stimulating drink and get my brain in, but we'll be back and we'll pick up the common law. So well, actually, we got some more to get through here. We might get through it maybe in 2 weeks instead of three. We'll be right back after this. Thank you so much.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so now that we're back from a break, welcome back, Tammy. And
thank you.
I just not getting enough sleep because of the pain. You know, it's really bad when you have enough pain that you can't sleep. So it's tough, yeah. Tough days. But that's okay. This is short-lived pain, and I'll live through it. But anyway, now we're going to go or dive into Governor Randolph's common law comments and kind of see what he's kind of covering. But let's kind of go through this, and then we'll dive into the next one. All right? Thanks.
Okay. All right. But he objects that the common law is not established by the Constitution. The wisdom of the convention is displayed by its omission, because the common law ought not to be immutably fixed. It is established in our own Constitution or the Bill of Rights, which has been resounded through the House. It is established only by an act of the legislature and can therefore be changed as circumstances may require it.
Okay, so that part right...
Go ahead.
So that part right there is really highlighted, folks. It is established only by an act of the legislature. So here's the question. Is it established? It's established as the law of the land, and they moved forward, but did they establish it as the law of the state government and the laws that they make? In other words, remember we just talked about this, right? Yesterday, maybe?
Yeah.
So we were talking about, you know, marriage and the state, you know, does it have the enumeration of marriage? Does the state regulate marriage? Absolutely it does. But if it's regulating marriage, but it's not in the Constitution, then they're violating that. And, it's common law. If they don't have common law declared, and I'm telling you, folks, at the state level, it's dangerous. Because they can assume and pull everything in. Now, let's look at it this way, because I think most people realize that in the secular, godless counties where large cities exist, their common law is going to basically deviate very dangerously from yours. They're going to possibly pass laws that allow, you know, different people to get married. Or, you know, other things that you would find repugnant morally, okay? So if they have common law in their county, and they do that in their county, then that's just constrained at the county level. If you give it to the state, then as all of these things come up to the state will then, and that's how they start using this jurisdiction over common law to get into the knickers of everything common law, and then can enforce and basically start supporting, even though you don't support it in your county, these types of marriages or, you know, these other types of things that would come into common law. And you go, oh my gosh, how'd this happen? Because you made the mistake of giving your state the authority over those things. They should be a general government and constrained by those things within the Constitution. Does that make sense?
I mean, yeah, absolutely. But
okay, so that's how the federal court started bringing things in. They actually started accepting things well outside their jurisdiction. They never had the jurisdiction to hear a case regarding marriage, period. Period.
Right.
And yet, they actually ruled on whether a baker could not make a cake or not. Does that arise under the Constitution? No.
Yeah, definitely no.
Okay. So, when it comes to appeals, it has to arise under that Constitution as well, folks. If it's under common law, then they can't usurp these types of things. They can't get engaged in those types of laws. The real problem was common law, and the states at this very point in time were theocracies. There were 8 states that actually had a symbiotic relationship with the state church. So the states, you know, the majority of the states in the Union were theocracies. And so they, you know, it was a righteous government, but you could only practice that faith. And so you wanted to practice a different faith, you had to move. And today, this would really rub a lot of people wrong. I mean, just think about how many people are in your particular faith in your state. Regardless, I mean, you know, you could be Catholic. Even Catholic is not a majority. And so if you had a theocracy today, it would be godless, because the majority of people are probably godless in most of the states. Or I should say definitely the heavily populated states. The red states, I think you'll find more people, but you still have to have a majority to actually do that and go down that path. Which is why that's why they started gravitating away from having a specific faith connected church. So when they broke the ties, they made a huge mistake by saying we're going to be non-denominational, and actually they went down the path of being secular. That's the same thing as non-denominational back then. That's the same thing. But instead, what they should have done was they should have said, we're casting off a single relationship, the symbiotic relationship with a single church, and what we want to do is we want to partner with all faiths. All Christian faiths we will partner with, so that, you know, we're not providing a monopoly, because they should be supporting the freedom of religion. That way, other faiths could, if they're, you know, contributing and they've created their own schools and so forth, they should be able to get a little stipend based on, you know, the magnitude of their influence, or, you know, membership or what have you. So maybe the Catholic Church might be dominating in some draw. But I think, and there's ways to actually look at this, but, and it's a little difficult to do, but I don't think it's impossible. I don't think it's that hard either, because I think the key thing, the state should not be contributing into a religious faith for school, education, those types of things, unless the people of the faith are the primary supporters of that faith. In other words, kind of like matching maybe 10% to the contributions. So if everybody in your faith was paying a full, honest tithe, you know, whatever that church decided what that was, if everybody was paying and the state paid 10% on that, then that was a little stipend that you would get to help feed those programs of education and those types of things, right? Or welfare programs, taking care of people. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Because if you don't, because let me point to a secular church, a godless church. All you need is one person, you know, like Soros, to come along and create a godless church and then throw, you know, all his money into that and then say, I want 10% of all the money I threw into this. Well, no, it has to be based on all of the members' contributions, not a single member. So if only one member contributed, they would... It's not member supported. It has to be member supported. That makes sense, right? And so there's a way to do that to ensure that something bad like that won't happen. Because I'm telling you, the only reason that people, the drug users and all of these godless people, are receiving welfare is because they've been entitled to it. And what happened was when we got rid of the welfare state, it wasn't fair that they couldn't get any. Well, hold on here. It's not that they couldn't get any. They just chose not to be in church. And that's where compassionate support comes from, is church. But when the state mm-hmm. stepped in to do it, they, because what happens is everybody knows you don't give money to alcoholics, the people that are killing themselves drinking, because they're just going to go buy alcohol. You don't give them money support. You got to get them off the alcohol. And that's the reason why the church model is so successful in really helping people become self-sufficient and to getting on their feet and becoming a contributor to society instead of a user, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's ways to do this.
Yeah, and you got to come to church.
There you go. And so, anyhow, let's keep going.
Okay. Let the honorable gentleman consider what would be the destructive consequences of its establishment in the Constitution. Even in England, where the firmest opposition has been made to encroachments upon it, it has been frequently changed. What would have been our dilemma if it had been established? Virginia has declared that children shall have equal portions of the real estate of their interstate parents, and it is consistent with the principles of a republican government. The immutable establishment of the common law would have been repugnant to that regulation. It would, in many respects, be destructive to Republicans' principles and productive of great inconveniences. I might indulge myself by showing many parts of the common law which would have this effect. I hope I shall not be thought to speak ludicrously when I say the right of burning heretics would have been revived by it. It would tend to throw real property into few hands and prevent the introduction of many salutary regulations. Thus, were the common law adopted in that system, it would destroy the principles of republican government. But this is not excluded. It may be established by an act of legislature. It is defective. Its defective parts may be altered, and it may be changed and modified as the convenience of the public may require it.
Now, we know that the congressional legislature, the federal legislature, cannot declare an act of common law. In other words, as he's repeated again, it may be established by an act of the legislature at the state level. But if it's not in the Constitution, and it is the law of the land because the territory was established that way, the only way they can change that is by an act to no longer declare common law to be the law of the state. But to actually make and give the state government the authority over common law, you have to amend the Constitution, because Congress can't do it. Because if it's not enumerated, they can't do it. Can they establish, you know, and or change the law of the land? No, it is all enumerated of what they've done and how it's to be done under that Constitution. So to actually be able to change the law of the land, for Congress to actually legitimately change it, there actually has to be an enumerated amendment to the Constitution granting them that power. And that power doesn't exist in your state legislature either. Even though common law is still the law of the land of the state, it's still something that the people of the state have a right to. You just don't have a court to go to. That's the problem. Because all of the courts have been established by the Bar Association, which has... They have nothing to do with common law. They have everything to do with their case law precedents and their abilities to create law. It is not common law. Okay, so anyway, let's go down, and we go down a ways through the next day, June 18th. And believe it or not, Mr. Henry brings up treaties, and we're going to look at what he says negatively about a treaty, and then we're going to see what Mr. Randolph says about treaties, and then we're going to see what Mr. Nicholas says about treaties. So go ahead first with Mr. Henry.
Okay, I don't have anything in yellow. Oh, there it is. Okay. A treaty may be made giving away your rights and inflicting unusual punishments on its violators. It is contended that if the King of Great Britain makes a treaty within the line of his prerogative, it is the law of the land. I agree that this is proper, and if I could see the same cheeks in that paper which I see in the British government, I would consent to it. Can the English monarch make a treaty which shall subvert the common law of England and the Constitution? Dare he make a treaty that shall violate Magna Carta or the Bill of Rights? Dare he do anything derogatory to the honor or subversive of the great privileges of his people? No, sir. If he did, it would be nugatory, and the attempt would endanger his existence.
Okay, so keep in mind, he's saying that Congress can make a treaty that takes away our rights. And that he points out that the king can't do it because they have the Magna Carta, because they have the Bill of Rights. So, again, he's using hyperbole, but let's see what Mr. Randolph says regarding treaties.
The honorable gentleman says that if you place treaties on the same footage here as they are in England, he will consent to the power because the king is restrained in making treaties. Will not the president and Senate be restrained? Being creatures of that constitution, can they destroy it? Can any particular body instituted for a particular purpose destroy the existence of the society for whose benefit it is created? It is said there is no limitation of treaties. I defy the wisdom of that gentleman to show how they ought to be limited. When the Constitution marks out the powers to be exercised by particular departments, I say no innovation can take place. An honorable gentleman says that this is the great charter of America. If so, will not the last clause of the fourth article of the Constitution secure against dismemberment? It provides that nothing in this Constitution shall be so construed as to prejudice any claims of the United States or of any particular state. And if this did not constitute security, it follows from the nature of civil association that no particular part shall sacrifice the whole.
So right here, Governor Randolph misses the mark. He doesn't really address the hard limitations in the Constitution regarding treaties. He missed it. So now we need to go down, and let's see what Mr. Nicholas says about treaties. This is the next day.
Okay. We have not seen in America that treaties were violated, though they are in all countries considered as the supreme law of the land. So, yeah, saying that treaties are considered the supreme law of the land. Was it not therefore necessary to declare in explicit terms that they shouldn't be so here? How then is this Constitution on different footing from the government of Britain? The worthy member says that they can make a treaty relinquishing our rights and inflicting punishments, because all treaties are declared paramount to the constitutions of the laws of the state. An attentive consideration of this will show the committee that they can do no such thing. The provision of the sixth article is that this Constitution and the laws of the United States, which shall be made in pursuance thereof, and all the treaties made or which shall be made under the authority of the United States, shall be the supreme law of the land. They can, by this, make no treaty which shall be repugnant to the spirit of the Constitution or inconsistent with the delegated powers. The treaties they make must be under the authority of the United States to be within their province. It is sufficiently secured because it only declares that in pursuance of the powers given, they shall be supreme law of the land, notwithstanding anything in the Constitution or laws of particular states.
Okay. So he clarifies it even better, doesn't he? Because he says it has to be under their authority. So they cannot make a treaty that they do not have within, as he says right here, with the delegated powers, or inconsistent with the delegated powers. In other words, if they made a treaty in regulating labor, international labor, we're going to get on board with this international labor requirement that everybody has to be union, instead of actually amending the Constitution, they're going to use a treaty. Do they have an enumeration in the Constitution over labor? No. So they don't have the authority to adjoin to that treaty and make it the supreme law of the land. It has to be, that treaty has to be within and derived from those powers. Does it have something to do with the uniform rule of naturalization? Yeah. They could probably make a treaty regarding a uniform rule of naturalization or regarding uniform laws over bankruptcies, so forth and so on. But they cannot use the treaty clause to actually subvert the Constitution or for anything that is not enumerated. Hopefully that's as clear as mud here. Right?
So Trump, for example, getting out of any treaties, like making an executive order to leave the Paris Climate Agreement or the TPP, like that would be in his delegated powers, right? Because it's not.
So actually, yes, he has the ability to recognize that they are, but it's not getting out of the treaty. He has to challenge the treaty as unconstitutional and therefore revoked. And he should actually then go after those members of Congress over in the Senate who actually voted for it to say, how dare you cross that line and pass a treaty where you didn't have the authority, and remove every one of those senators that voted for it. That's big, isn't it? Because they directly, that was an insurrection against the Constitution. That's what he could do. And what he's doing is he's playing these games with lawyers so that they all stay within these unconstitutional legal boundaries. He needs to break through that crap. He needs to break into the Constitution and break through these unconstitutional reframings of our jurisprudence, of the legal system, of the laws that these judges and Congress and everybody's been adding and making it, this whole facade. He could actually do that, but the only way to make these types of things stick is he has to appeal to the states to interpose. He has to go to the states and say, you need to constrain Congress and don't let them do these things anymore. You have to draw the line and say, you don't have the authority to do these things. He has the authority to execute the laws of the land and to not execute unconstitutional laws. But he can't actually get rid of these things permanently, like education and so forth. He has to go to the states to do that. Mr. Henry pipes in again on common law. This is one of those little, you know, gets into their craw, and he wants to chew on it some more and, you know, go forth and so forth. Notice here he's going to cite Blackstone. So go ahead, and I'll address it after you're done.
Henry, next thing I have is under George Mason.
No, so you got George Mason, Mr. Corbin, Mr. Henry, and then common law. Underneath Mr. Nicholas, treaties. Yeah, it's only three down from the treaties. Okay.
Okay, so where do you want me to read the common law one?
Yes, Mr. Henry, common law.
Okay. I might go in this discrimination, but it is too obvious that the security of territory is no security of individual safety. I ask, how are the states' rights, individual rights, and national rights secured? Not as in England, for the authority quoted from Blackstone would, if stated right, prove in 1,000 instances that if the King of England attempted to take away the rights of individuals, the law would stand against him. The Acts of Parliament would stand in his way. The Bill and Declaration of Rights would be against him. The common law is fortified by the Bill of Rights. The rights of the people cannot be destroyed, even by the paramount operation of the law of nations, as the case of the Russian ambassador evinces. If you look for similar security in the paper on your table, you look in vain. That paper is defective without such a declaration of rights. It is unbounded with such restrictions. If the Constitution be paramount, how are the constitutions of the laws of the states to stand? Their operation will be totally controlled by it, for it is paramount to everything unless you can show some guard against it. The rights of persons are exposed as it stands now.
again, he's making the assertion that the Constitution gives general powers to regulate all things within the states. When it comes to commerce, can the federal government regulate commerce within the states? Actually, the Constitution says specifically that they can regulate commerce among the states, not within the states. So Henry right here is again, you know, creating this fear that this Constitution has, you know, unlimited powers, even though they tell you that these powers are enumerated, and he can't prove that the very specific general powers are actually enumerated in the Constitution. He's not proven that. He just is pointing to England because they have general powers. The Bill of Rights and such actually protect the people from those types of powers. And then he's basically making this huge leap that the Constitution's just like the England. This government's just like England. And without that Bill of Rights, they're going to stamp and trample upon the states, and they're going to trample upon the people, and so forth. And it's all a lie. If Henry, he's not a dumb man. He is literally posing as a fearmonger to say, you know, all things are equal here. And they're not. This Constitution was constantly justified that it only delegated very specific powers. And only those powers were considered the supreme law of the land. The laws made in pursuant to those powers. They've constantly tried to make this association that the exclusive legislation law, or the power to make exclusive legislation for the District of Columbia and those properties under the federal government, i.e., the, you know, forts, magazines, because not states. States are sovereign and independent states. The territory, they have the ability to regulate and make rules for the territory, but once that territory becomes a state, it's all bets are off. So what Henry is doing is he's being completely disingenuous. He's basically trying to obviate that this Constitution isn't what everybody is saying it is. And yet he's not proving that these things are in the Constitution. He's just making this broad connection that all things are equal. So now we go into, again, Mr. Henry, I think, says one, again, common law. And then I think we get into a few people like Mr. Pendleton and others that talk a little bit more about common law. Apparently, this is the, you know, we talked a lot about the militia a few days ago, and now it's all about common law and the Bill of Rights. So go ahead, let's finish this one little comment on common law.
Okay, we have about 20 seconds.
Oh, okay, never mind. That's not enough. Thank you for pointing that out. So is this, are we going into break or are we done for the day?
This is done for the day.
Hey, when you make a mistake, you got to fess up to it, right? And I apologize. So anyway, so what we're going to do is we're going to move forward with these. There's still a lot that we still need to get through with the Virginia ratification debates. But we're getting close. I mean, we're pretty close to finishing this. The next one will be the North Carolina debates, and we'll probably not go into the New York debates because there's other content we need to get through before we get to Constitution Month or Constitution Day and forwards or on from there, because that's where we read the Constitution. Bottom line, I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaim the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.